Welcome to Green and Red, Scrappy Politics for Scrappy People, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the silky smooth sounds of the Green and Red podcast. I'm Scott Parkin, your co-host in Berkeley, California. And as always, I am joined by
Bob Bazanko. I am geographically in Houston, Texas, but mentally I'm in Niles, Ohio.
Your heart is in Niles, Ohio. And folks, we're going to be talking about Niles, Ohio's other favorite son, which is also Trump's favorite president. Bob is probably Trump's favorite Marxist history professor, if we're being real, if we're being honest about it. But we're going to be talking about President William McKinley, who was president in the late 1890s up until 1901 when he was assassinated. But Trump evokes William McKinley quite a bit. He changed the name of Mount Denali in Alaska back to Mount McKinley in one of his great executive orders. Trump evokes his tariffs. He talks about some of the foreign policy interventions that McKinley did when he was president. And so we thought we would like dive deep a little bit into who William McKinley was, as it were. So I'll let Bob take it from there because I feel like I'm rambling.
No, I live in Niles, Ohio half a year, pretty soon full time. And about a mile from where I live in Niles, Ohio is the birthplace of William McKinley, who, and to be a bit humble, I would say Stockton and Niles Lit are the second most famous Niles people. But yeah, McKinley is not like one of our better known political figures in American history. You know, people know who he is. They know his name. He was assassinated. A curiosity, but really overshadowed by Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, and other people in that generation. So when Trump said that was his favorite president, I got a chuckle out of it because I know a little bit about McKinley. And it took on some legs, and you're starting to see a little more attention given to that. Like, he changed the name back to Mount McKinley. And it's fun, and I thought people don't really know much about this, and there's a lot going on beyond McKinley. McKinley's not the most exciting guy, but that era is like insanely important, critically important. You know, the Civil War, he was the last U.S. president who served in the Civil War, so he's a bridge in that area, right? And he was really active in this kind of period of industrialization. So you have the deindustrialization of the United States. And he was that was how he made his bones politically, talking about issues like tariffs and currency. A very famous tariff in 1890 that he sponsored, the McKinley tariff. And then, of course, he was the president in America's like kind of big foray into building an empire in the 1890s. This is the period, especially with the War of 1898, right, when the United States goes after Cuba, Hawaii before that, Philippines, and so on.
Puerto Rico.
Yeah, it's a very substantial period. And McKinley, it's fun to talk about it for me, but it's actually a pretty substantial time. And I think it says a lot, too, the fact that Trump would invoke him, right? Remember, in his first term, his favorite president was Andrew Jackson, right? And he's, I think, trying to recreate resettlement policies, like the way they destroyed Native American culture, like now with immigrants and stuff. But now, apparently, he's moved on to William McKinley. I also want to just say in passing that a couple of weeks ago, I was on a show talking about neoliberalism. And at the end, I just briefly mentioned that I didn't think Trump really was a neoliberal. And that's not the point of this show. But somebody, one of the esteemed, brilliant New York people, got his start in Brooklyn, said that it was silly to say that Trump was not a neoliberal, right? Because he wasn't a liberal, right? I found it interesting that lefties would engage in such binary thinking. But I would like to actually engage that too, because in a very simplistic way, if your favorite president, the guy you want to emulate is William McKinley, you ain't a neoliberal. You're actually going back like before corporate liberalism, right? So a lot of stuff there to talk.
Neo-monarchist maybe.
Yeah, King Trump, right? McKinley, it was born in Niles, Ohio, in a place on what is today Main Street, right? And grew up in Ohio, became a lawyer, served in the Civil War, was elected to Congress, and so on. Now, the period is really important because in the period after the Civil War is when the Civil War ends the kind of two different systems in the United States, right? We have this agrarian system in the South, industrialization in the North. And so the Civil War solidifies the idea that this is a capitalist, industrial capitalist country. And that's McKinley emerges in that era, right? And which is, I think, really important because he's part of that. He joined the Republican Party. The Republican Party wasn't even created until the 1850s and emerges out of the Free Soil Party. It's a challenge to the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party, remember, is the party of agriculture and slavery. And so the Republican stand, the motto, before becoming Republicans, the Free Soil Party was free soil, free labor, free man, which is very much a proto-capitalist ideology, right? Land should be available, things like homesteading, free soil, right? Free labor means that we believe in wage slavery, not chattel slavery. So the Republican Party is anti-slavery from an economic perspective. Free soil, free labor, and free men means that the men who engage in this work are free. So it's a free labor ideology, which means that you're free to come and go, right? You can't be held in bondage like you would be if you're a slave, right? So that's the Republican ideology in which McKinley emerges politically. He becomes a Republican in Ohio, which makes plenty of sense because that was clearly the dominant, the growing party in the North, right? And he became part of that. He defended workers. He defended labor, became pretty well known in a trial in 1871. 23 miners who had gone on strike, I believe, were fired or arrested, and McKinley defended them and got 22 of the 23 acquitted, right? Becomes known that way. He was their pro bono lawyer, in fact, and that raised his standing with workers in Ohio, with Ohio labor. But what's really interesting out of that is that one of the owners of the mines, who essentially McKinley was essentially suing, right? He was up against them, right? But one of the owners at that trial was a guy named Mark Hanna, and that's how they got to know each other. And that's going to be really critically important. Later, Mark Hanna is one of the more important figures of late 19th century U.S. history. Just as an aside, because I was mentioning Ohio earlier, the William McKinley Memorial and Library is in Niles. It's actually a really beautiful building, right? And it's like a portico outside, and there's just statues, like Roman, like almost Romanesque. But the statues are of McKinley and his people. So there's statues of Mark Hanna and John Hay and Salmon B. Chase and Sherman. And when you go inside the library, the big statue right there is Frick, Henry Clay Frick, who wrote Strikes and stuff, right? And
industrial. Robert Barron, yeah, industrious type.
And it's just a joke. It's like the Hall of Fame of industrial capitalism, right? The founders, right? These are like the Babe Ruth and Ty Cobbs of industrial capitalism in America. What's striking, which I always tell people, is that area, Ohio, the Mahoning Valley there is like a really important labor area. And you had like really important strikes there, labor organizations, unions. The little steel strike was waged in Youngstown, right? In 1977, when the factory shut down, that kind of the industrialization process started in Youngstown and places like that, right? But at the McKinley Memorial, there's not a single statue to anybody on that side, on the side of labor, right? It's just a glorification of capital, which I think is funny, but that's kind of America, right? That's American history. So that's McKinley. And Hanna is a really important part of that, too. Hanna is a big shaker in the Ohio Republican Party, which dominates American politics. Weren't there six presidents from Ohio or something like that? Like Garfield and Hayes and Grant and McKinley. And I'm pretty sure there were others, too. And
Warren G. Harding. Governor of Ohio before he was president.
What was the show that Buscemi did after Sopranos? Wasn't it
Boardwalk Empire?
Wasn't Hanna and those guys, weren't they like kind of part of that arc?
There was an arc around Teapot Dome.
Harding was there too. Yeah.
It was around Teapot Dome as the scandal in which Harding got implicated in.
Yeah. I'm surprised that's not Trump's favorite president because Harding was always messing around with other women and bearing children out of wedlock and stuff like that. That's far more Trump than.
I think wasn't Harding's campaign platform return to normalcy? Maybe Trump return the normalcy part.
Although didn't Biden say that? Because Americans want normalcy, right? Yes. Anyway, McKinley becomes known in Republican circles. In 1876, he was elected to the U.S. Congress, and he was acknowledged as an expert on tariffs. That became his big deal. Now, tariffs obviously are a big issue right now, and that's obviously a big reason why Trump claims that McKinley is his favorite president. And not to go too much into it, this isn't an economics discussion, but tariffs are critical in an industrialization period. Tariffs are really essential for developing countries. And the United States in the 1870s is a developing country. Earlier, it's basically like today you call it like a third world country, right? The U.S. in the early 19th century, because it's agricultural, there's not really much capitalist development. They're only starting now to build things like canals and highways and things like that. And so even after World War II, we're still in that phase where you're industrializing and tariffs are essential to that, right? Because industry can't compete with British industry or German industry or anything like that. They're just too far behind still. So tariffs are essential, right? In that regard, what tariffs do, and the U.S. government had been imposing tariffs from the 1800s on, the famous 1828 tariff, right? The idea behind tariffs is you impose heavy taxes on foreign markets so that when they sell their goods in the U.S., they come into the U.S., the importer pays those taxes and then passes it on, obviously. But the point is, because those taxes are so high, because those tariffs are so high, those goods will now cost more than domestic made goods. And so what you're going to do is favor the domestic market, right? So like in 1828, they wanted to support Northern, you know, like textiles and iron and construction and things like that. So you impose these heavy tariffs on British goods coming in, especially in textiles. And so what you do is you preserve a market, you create a market, preserve a market for Northern textile manufacturers. Their goods are going to cost more, right? Because they're no longer in the same market conditions. They're protected now. They're called protective tariffs, right? Because now the stuff coming in from Britain was going to cost more because of the tariffs. So the American stuff will be cheap. The stuff made in Massachusetts or Connecticut or Rhode Island or wherever will be cheaper, right? But in retaliation for that, so consumers are going to pay higher prices. But in retaliation, Britain imposed tariffs on Southern agricultural commodities too. So the South suffered. So tariffs are, that's not the free market at work. It's very far away from that, right? But they were essential. So it made sense for McKinley, being a party that represents labor, and McKinley himself being considered pro-labor, would be supportive of tariffs. Labor wanted tariffs. The AFL at the time, all the unions, the late 1800s, supported the idea of tariffs. It was essential. For an advanced country, like the biggest, one of the biggest countries in the world, like today, tariffs have to be viewed very differently. We can talk about it at the end. Because I'm sure when Trump says, I like McKinley, I love tariffs, tariff wars are fun. What do you say? Tariff is his favorite word in the dictionary or something like that. Yeah. And
the most amazing word in the dictionary.
First off, tariffs in 1890 are very different than tariffs in 2025. And also important to note, tariffs in 1890 didn't really work either. Tariffs are in smaller, developing, emerging economies use them because it protects them and they're able to develop like the U.S. did in the early 1800s, right? But it's, and that was before we had this global capitalist system as well. So it's very different. So it's another one where Trump just throws some idea out, obviously doesn't understand it. So McKinley became a congressman. He was inaugurated in 1877. And this is really, 1877 is the year, I'm not going to go into detail on this, but that's also the year where there was a very controversial election the previous year between Samuel Tilden and Rutherford B. Hayes. The election was thrown into the House and Hayes won. But in order to make that work, Congress created what was called the Grand Compromise or the Compromise of 1877, which ended Reconstruction in the South, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff, right? So
the other important thing happening in this period too is when this is around when Haymarket was in 1876 or 1877.
Haymarket's 1886. The Great Strike is in 1877, right?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Exactly. And this is a time of increasing labor conflict, class consciousness, class violence is going on too.
It's with industrial workers, I guess.
With industrial brutal. Like in 1877, those strikes were nationwide. Over 100 people were killed, mostly workers, and over $100 million in property was destroyed. Workers were burning railroads. They were burning bridges.
That's in 1870 dollars, 1870s dollars.
Yeah. So it was like really massive. And I mean, in some cities, workers' councils took over. Like in Pittsburgh, they kicked everybody out of City Hall and took over for a week or something like that. Yeah, exactly. And that's important because that's the environment, political environment in which McKinley is emerging. So you have this increasing industrialization, which has a bunch of economic precarity involved with it. The economy's up and down throughout the entire post-Civil War period. You have a great deal of labor conflict, a great deal of unrest, including violent class conflict, right? With government suppression. And the government sends out the police and militias and even the army at various points, right? That's how McKinley emerges. So it makes sense that he'd be a Republican, that he would be pro-labor, and that he would support tariffs. And so I think that's really his importance. He also early on, and I'm only mentioning this because it's going to be important when he runs for president in 1896, but along with tariffs, he was into currency, monetary policy, right? And in addition to advocating tariffs, because that would help industry, right? But he also advocated currency, changing the currency supply in the United States. Essentially, a lot of farmers, especially some northern workers, but this was especially popular in agricultural areas, and it will become really important in the 1890s. But a lot of them presented the idea that the United States, which was on a gold standard at the time, needed to change its monetary system. Essentially, you had a ratio. So you had to peg the actual amount of money in circulation, which importantly means the amount of money available as credit from banks, right? That was always pegged to gold. There was a certain ratio for it, right? Which meant that the money supply was always short. It was limited. And which meant that it was expensive to buy money, right? It would cost more, right? So what farmers suggested, and especially after the Civil War, there were these silver mines discovered in places like Nevada, Utah, I believe, Colorado, and elsewhere, right? That's maybe where that's John Sayles got the idea for Silver City, right?
But also why we saw like a lot of like really bloody labor struggle around the silver mines in Colorado.
Exactly. Oh, absolutely. Ludlow was 1912, right? I don't think that was a silver mine, but still. Yeah, it's, I don't know if it is or not, is it? Maybe it was, I remember. It was Rockefeller owned it. Anyway, neither here nor there.
I also want to note that this is also probably why Trump is going to inspect for it this week.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah. He wanted to make sure all the gold is there. They didn't take the gold.
Yeah, exactly.
They're sneaking out gold bars in their pockets at any rate. But so they suggested to take all this silver and basically go to a bimetallic system, right? So that both silver, both gold and silver would be minted, would be official currency. So you would, and this would be like today we talk about running the printing presses or quantitative easing. This is what we're talking about, right? It's essentially they want to inflate the money supply so that money is now available to workers and farmers. And McKinley jumped on that as well in 1877. So he was an advocate both of tariffs and he voted to monetize silver to increase the money supply, right? Now, the second part of that, he's definitely going to flip on for sure. But he was a pro-labor candidate. He was pro-silver. In fact, in 1878, he voted for a law called the Bland-Allison Act that would require the government purchase large quantities of silver. On a personal level, McKinley also, after he was born in Niles, moved to Canton, Ohio, which is like 45 minutes away. In fact, a little bit of Ohio trivia, both Canton and Niles public high schools are named McKinley. And we play them in like sports. So it would be the Battle of the McKinleys, Canton McKinley versus Niles McKinley, right? But that area had industrialized and had become prosperous in the early 19th century, especially because it was making farm equipment. So there was a great deal of farm equipment production there. So it's manufacturing goods. So it's a manufacturing area, right? So that's another reason that McKinley would have a personal investment in this, right? And McKinley got appointed to the Ways and Means Committee, which is as important as any committee in Congress, right? They get to decide where the money goes, right? And he got, and what's also important, I think, is that around this time, he became much more involved with Mark Hanna. He and Hanna knew each other. They met in court, but it's really when McKinley's in Congress and he's from Ohio and Hanna is, I guess you'd call him a fixer today, right? Or a kingmaker, right? Although Hanna himself was a politician.
He's been compared to Karl Rove a lot because he did a lot to get McKinley around.
Absolutely. When we get to that. Yeah. He's the reason McKinley became president. Absolutely. Yep. Hanna is very well connected. Just a word on him, Mark Hanna, because he's important as well. And if Trump says McKinley's his favorite president, you don't get just McKinley. You got to take everything that comes with it. That includes Mark Hanna and all these other guys, right?
Right.
Mark Hanna was raised in Cleveland. I believe he knew Rockefeller because Rockefeller's from Cleveland too. John D. Rockefeller. After the Civil War, Hanna invested like a lot of people did, aspiring young businessmen. They would be the tech bros of their day. But Hanna invested in oil refineries and shipping, which didn't go well. It failed. That's the other thing we talk about, the Gilded Age. A lot of businesses went under in that era, right? A lot of fortunes were lost. Hanna failed. His first foray into business was a disaster. But then he did what any good, hardworking young man would do. He married into somebody whose father owned a business. He's a successful, right. So he took over for his father and he moved, expanded. The guy was a sharp businessman in the era, right? And he expanded into all kinds of stuff. Coal, steel, railroads, industry, all kinds of stuff. And he was very active in Republican politics, which again, and that's the important thing to remember. The Republican Party at the time, because people like Ted Cruz last year tweeted like the Democrats were the party of slavery. Yeah, they were. But like that was in 1870, right? The Republican Party is the party of slavery now, right? But Hanna became active in the Republican Party in the 1870s. And that's, so the Republican Party is a Northern industrial party, right? And they believe they're anti-slavery. They believe in labor rights. They're not radicals or anything like that. They certainly don't believe in the Wobblies or anything like that, but they do defend the rights of labor. It would be.
And just to be clear on the anti-slavery thing, that was, they were anti-slavery in the Northern states. It doesn't necessarily mean, I mean, it did. The abolitionists obviously wanted to abolish slavery in the Southern states, but anti-slavery in places like Ohio and Illinois meant they just didn't want slavery there competing with, you know, their free wage labor. Their wage labor, whatever.
Yeah. Free labor and wage labor, the terms they use. Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. The Republican Party was an anti-slavery party, but they were really opposed to the extension of slavery, the expansion of slavery.
Exactly.
Although Hannah, there was an anecdote I read there somewhere on the internet. I was just skimming because I wanted some details. A lot of this stuff, like I said, I've studied this much of my life, but a lot of it I need to just get the details straight, right? Hannah apparently, though, was involved in a debate where the debate question was like, essentially, who's treated worse, blacks or Indians in the United States? And Hannah said it was ex-slaves. Blacks were treated worse than anybody, and he won the debate. And that's not that surprising. These guys aren't like racially conscious. They're not woke. Right? I guess in 1877, that would be woke. Actually, William McKinley's kind of woke, isn't he? You think about it.
He did some early civil rights stuff when he was governor of Ohio, right?
Yeah. Oh, Ohio was a big anti-slavery area. The Underground Railroad to Ohio. So you have, especially on the border there, because the southern border of Ohio is right there in Kentucky, which is a southern state, right? Essentially, if you cross the Ohio River into Ohio, it was important. Isn't that how, wasn't Oberlin College started by people from the Underground Railroad, I believe, right? And which is up north, not far from Cleveland, right? At any rate, Hannah's active in Republican politics, which is not surprising. In 1880, Hannah really made his bones. He was a fixer, a kingmaker. He knew people all over. He was connected to businesses all over. Ohio was the headquarters of the Republican Party, that Garfield and Sherman. In 1880, Hannah essentially single-handedly brought the presidency to James Garfield, who wasn't really the most best-known or popular guy. Hannah worked tirelessly. He raised a ton of money, which is going to come in really handy when McKinley runs for president. Hannah worked the media. He got endorsements from other politicians. He made deals to get people to drop out of or were considering running for president, to drop out, to endorse Garfield, and so forth. And he got Garfield elected. So at that point, Hannah became very well known. And he had a bunch of business posts, and he was nominated for like consultancies and things like that. He actually did serve as a senator from Ohio. I don't remember the years, but he was a senator. Remember back then, senators were appointed. They weren't elected. Hannah obviously could. It was very easy for him to get somebody to appoint him to a Senate seat. And it was in this era, like the late 1880s, when he became much closer to William McKinley. And they bonded again over the issue of tariffs. And this is really critical. And this is where we're coming from now. And again, I can't stress this enough. We're talking about in a tariffs in an era when American industry was nascent. It was not dominant yet. The British, the French, and the Germans are all outpacing the United States in manufacturing output in the period after the Civil War. The U.S. is clearly growing, but it's not an industrial power. It doesn't have industrial hegemony or anything like that yet. So again, that's really critical to understand when you talk about tariffs. And so they were advocates of tariffs in that era, which made sense because essentially that's the way industry operated. That was one of the basic rules of capitalist industrialization, right? You're protected with tariffs. So the idea that the government wasn't involved in the economy, which we hear all the time, regulations are bad, we want the free hand of the market, and there's too much bureaucracy, and you need to stay out of the government and all this kind of stuff. That was never the ideal. That wasn't part of capitalist ideology. Capitalist ideology demanded significant government intervention, and tariffs were like a huge component of that. And the point behind that was to protect these northern industries. And what better way to protect these northern industries? Well, take control of government, right? And these guys this is the Gilded Age, too. I guess we should have talked about that at first, right? But that's really critical. Mark Twain coined that term. And it really did represent, I think, a lot that was going on in this era, this kind of like immense wealth. And it's probably, and maybe that's the reason Trump likes McKinley, right? He wants to revert back to the Gilded Age, which I actually think is what he's doing.
Even people in the circle say we're in this new golden age. They say Golden Age, but because I think Gilded Age is a derisive term, which they don't want to be associated with.
Yeah. And again, like just to be a smart ass, I never pass a chance to take a shot at somebody from the New York left, but it's not neoliberal. It's not. If this is what you emulate, you're not a neoliberal, but we can bring that up again at the end if you want to. But at any rate, McKinley attaches his star to Mark Hanna, and Hanna got him elected to, can't help get him elected to Congress in 1890. McKinley kind of, I guess, reached his legislative apex with the so-called McKinley tariff. He was the chair of the Ways and Means Committee in the House and got a government tariff law passed. It raised import rates in many cases to about 50%. Trump has bandied a lot. You notice Trump hasn't really done a lot on tariffs yet. I suspect the guy doesn't listen to anybody, but I got to believe that maybe Jamie Dimon and people like that were calling him up and saying, hey, back off on the tariffs or something. I don't know. But it has slowed down. So we'll see what happens.
There's a level of everything that Trump does to be smoke and mirrors, to be real.
Yeah.
And that one weekend, he tweeted that he's going to put these big tariffs on Mexico and Canada and China. And then they went into like negotiations. He got, I would say, Trudeau and Sheinbaum are actually much more skilled negotiators than the guy who wrote The Art of the Deal. And he came out on the losing end of the negotiations. But then he tweets out that he won, which is pretty much his pattern of how he does things, just to put out there.
Yeah.
Like he's, I think that the thing we need to just say here is that in many ways, especially when it comes to actually policy or economic policy, he's really just an idiot. He's pretty smart at making people like him and vote for him, but he's an idiot on this stuff, frankly.
He's an idiot. And that's why I think if you're going to say my hero is McKinley and you want to emulate him, then you should probably understand what that really means. And it's insane, right? So McKinley's tariffs are like really huge, right? They were Republican based, right? Republicans controlled the House, in fact, in 1890. And they were, of course, based on the northern industry. So it makes sense for people from Ohio to advocate for a tariff because that's who they represent. Both the industrialists who make more money, right? But also the workers there, right? Obviously, the NABM tariffs is to increase profits too. You guys are like, oh, we're going to make workers better off. But the reality is obviously very different. And that's the way it worked out. And the tariff of 1890, and this is the part that nobody, even the media, is really mentioning when Trump says, I want to be tariff, Mr. Tariff Order. Tariff wars are fun and easy to win or whatever he says, right? The tariff of 1890 wasn't popular and it didn't work. It raised costs. It raised consumer prices. It raised inflation. A small group of people, maybe 5% or so of workers, increased their wages in heavy industries like iron and steel. The rest of the economy suffered significantly from it. And in fact, in the election that fall, after the tariff of 1890, the McKinley tariff was passed, that fall, the GOP was trounced in the midterms. And the Democrats took control of the House back. And Dwight McKinley lost his seat in 1890. So he paid the price for these tariffs. They did not work economically. And in fact, I'm not sure how much of the connection is because I've read about it. In 1893, you have one of the worst economic crashes in U.S. history. The Panic of 1893, which is right up there with 1837 and 1929 and now 2020, right? In American history, right? The economy in the post-Civil War years was just erratic as hell, up and down. Deflation, inflation, monetary crashes, all that kind of stuff. And then the tariffs really actually make things worse. And this is also the era of, we talked about workers' discontent earlier, right? But it's in this era that you're seeing like Homestead and Pullman occurring. So there's all this.
The disgruntled farmers with the populace.
Well, yeah, we're going to talk about that. Yeah, because that becomes the issue in American politics. And McKinley's right in the middle of all. So that's really critical. But McKinley lost his own seat by defending these tariffs, which didn't work well. But he bounced back very quickly in 1892 with Hanna again orchestrating it. He ran for governor of Ohio and won. And Hanna immediately began working behind the scenes, looking forward to 1896, right? The president was Grover Cleveland Part One, right? What did Grandpa Simpson say? He was spanked by Grover Cleveland in two non-consecutive days or something like that. Yeah. And Grover Cleveland wasn't like obviously the most popular guy. Cleveland had been elected with labor votes too. And in 1894, called the Army Act, right? He wasn't a terribly strong candidate either, actually decided not to run, right? Hanna begins laying the groundwork for 1896 to get the Republican nomination. And he did. And I think there's a little bit of context is really important here. 1896 is like a really watershed year in American politics. We had said before, the idea behind the tariffs is to develop kind of economic stability. That was as far away as ever. In the 1890s, right? You have Pullman and all. Jacob Coxey's army was in 1894, I believe, right?
These right.
Disgruntled, like 10,000 disgruntled unemployed workers marched on Washington, D.C. So there's this kind of crisis all over the United States going on. You have over in both agriculture and industry. So you're making too many goods. They're just sitting there. Inventory's piling up. You're not selling stuff. People are losing their jobs. Factories are shuttering. You have deflation. It's a mess, right? And that's the context in which McKinley emerges as the Republican standard bearer, but it's also the context in which a group called the populist emerge. And that's too, because the word populism has been bastardized so much now. And it's frustrating. I mention this all the time when I lecture. If you're going to use a word, then you need to say, okay, this is a 2025 version of the word, because that's not how it got started. Populism emerged out of like a 2025 year uprising in rural America. It had been going on for quite some time. There were actually strong socialist parties throughout the farm states, places like Kansas, Nebraska, Texas,
even Oklahoma.
And those are the places where this populist movement got started. Populist farmers after the Civil War were suffering significantly because of mechanization, because of the Civil War, the emergence of people who would go into southern areas and buy huge tracts of land, the inavailability of credit. So farmers are losing their land in droves. There were states like Mississippi, Indiana, I don't know if it was Mississippi, it was Indiana, Kentucky, Indiana, Kansas, and like Nebraska, where you saw population drops of 50%. People like in agriculture really just bailed because there was no work there. There was nothing there. And so farmers began to organize collectively. You had the Grange in the 1870s. They formed buyers co-ops and producers and consumers co-ops. They formed insurance companies and banks. Companies like today, like State Farm, Planters Bank, Farmers Bank, those are still around, products of this era from the farmers. And then the Grange falls off because there are more economic crises. And then you have these farmers alliances and so forth. But in the 1890s, it really emerges as a major force of American politics. In 1892, a group that was centered in the West and South, a group that was strong in the South and the West, especially among farmers and working people, emerged called the People's Party. And the People's Party was an alternative to both the Democrats and the Republicans. It was a party specifically to represent working people and farmers. It would be considered, I think, pretty progressive today, right? It nominated a Civil War general named James Weaver for president, and it ran a class-based campaign, right? In fact, and this always, like the first time I read this, it struck me, and I still think it's a big deal. In 1892, Weaver, one of his slogans was, this is a contest, an election of the masses versus the classes, right? The masses, the people and the classes, the rich guys, Rockefeller and Carnegie, all those people. I can't think of a time in American politics when a candidate of a party that actually was a third party, to be sure. But as we'll see, it did quite well. But I can't think of a time when a candidate for a party that had significant support couched it in those kinds of terms, right? The masses versus the classes. Roosevelt never said that. Lyndon Johnson never said that. JFK never said that.
Joe Biden never said that.
Joe Biden never said that.
Hey, most pro-labor president in American history.
And history, yeah. Oh, boy. So that the People's Party in 1892 did quite well. They actually won local elections, and they got people elected to state legislatures. They maybe even got a governor elected or something like that. And I'm going quickly here and skipping a lot of steps. So the People's Party then morphed into what we call the Populist Party. Populism is a movement. It's a movement based on things like class. Also had a religious kind of an evangelical component to it, which I'm not going to go into, but it's clearly a movement based on class. And so the populists create this program, which is in many ways, I think it is the most anti-capitalist political platform ever like put forward by a party that actually did pretty well in it. I think in the history of the United States, because we love to lionize and romanticize groups and things like that. But I think there are two movements that like legitimately pose an anti-capitalist threat, not a huge threat, but something of a serious threat to the ruling class. One was clearly the populist. We'll talk about, I would say the other was the early stages of King's Poor People's Campaign, right? Because now you're talking about integrating people. Before the populists, there were groups called farmers alliances. Those were segregated. So you had a black farmers alliance and a white farmers alliance, right? What the populists did was actually integrate, which was really very progressive, obviously. So in the initial phases of the populist movement, both black and white farmers were an important part of that. And they often ran for office on the same ticket, right? So here in Texas, I think, what's the county up by? I don't know if it's Grimes, like College Station. Is that Grimes County?
College Station is Brazos County.
Brazos County? And it was somewhere up there. Maybe it was Brazos County. And one of those counties up there by that area off of what would today be like 90. And one of those counties, the populist actually put a ticket forward to run for sheriff and assistant or vice sheriff or whatever. The sheriff was white. The associate sheriff, vice sheriff was black. And they won. They won the election. Now, a mob went out and lynched them, but they did win the election. Yay. It's Texas, right? They also, so they have this idea of having kind of an integrated movement. One of the famous populists of the day was a guy named Tom Watson, Georgia, who became a vicious race baiter after that. But early on, Watson said, of course, we'll allow black farmers in. They're in the same ditch as we are, right? So it has its really class consciousness. And you can see that because part of the platform included, but has things like women's vote. Women in the United States got to vote legally for the first time in states where the populists were, like either governor or had significant role in the legislature or something like that. So they were advocates of women's vote. They were advocates of a significant public education system. The public education system in the U.S. in many ways is going to be attributed to populist ideas, but they also attack capitalism. And this is directly what, so they're obviously the counterpoise to McKinley, right? McKinley is the candidate and the politician of capitalist growth, right? And you do everything you can, whether it be tariffs or whatever, right? The populists had a very different idea. Theirs is a class-based movement. And so among their suggestions, three were really stood out, right? One is they wanted the government because farmers weren't getting credit, right? They weren't unable to get credit. As I said, there's this, you know, economic crash going on. And the tariffs made things worse. The tariffs of 1890, which is something like, if you're going to talk about the McKinley tariffs, you need to mention that. They didn't work, right? Just like the Smoot-Hawley tariffs didn't work. Neoliberals don't like tariffs. Neoliberals created the WTO and NAFTA. The whole point of neoliberalism is allegedly free trade, right? So it's just a preposterous idea. And to see these people get all, I'm sorry, this is a rant. This is an aside, a peripheral, but like you could fast forward through it or something. It's like to basically mock people for suggesting Trump might not be a neoliberal in this kind of condescending way. Well, of course he's not a neo, of course he's a neo because he's not a liberal. Like that's all you could be. Hey, Jesus Christ. At any rate, but neither here nor there. So the populists proposed that the government create a bank for farmers. They called it a sub-treasury plan. So they essentially wanted a public agricultural bank, right? Banking, just like every other industry, is privately owned. That's the whole point of capitalism, right? The means of production, the banks, the factories, everything, the means of production and finance are controlled by private individuals. So the idea of demanding a state bank and pledging that you would create a state bank, a national bank, is a big deal. That's not capitalism. You can imagine how private bankers thought what Wall Street thought of that idea. We're going to create government banks that would compete. And the idea there was it would be that the interest rates would be by law limited to certain levels, and farmers would be able to promise future crops as collateral. So it would be, they'd be able to get money without too much hassle at a pretty reasonable price. As you can imagine, like big banks, Wall Street banks hated this idea, right? So on that, this is an anti-capitalist movement, populist, right? They also, because banks were their biggest enemy. Everybody hated bankers. So I was talking to class the other day. I played Jolly Banker by Woody Guthrie. I showed that scene from The Grapes of Wrath. Who do we shoot talking about the bankers, right? And so bankers are a big problem. And the populists thought that they were the big enemy because the credit wasn't available to agriculture. Banks, just like the government, and this is really important. And this is, McKinley is really important in this regard, right? McKinley emerges in an era and he believes that the government and the instruments of private capital, especially banks, exist to benefit industry and promote capitalist development. That's really critical. McKinley isn't dealing with an advanced, or in this particular case, as we are, a late stage capitalist country. He's dealing with a country in its earliest phase of industrial capitalism. And that's important. And that's why, like, you can't replicate 1890 and 2025. It's just a silly idea, right?
It's partially, he's, and some of the things I was looking at, he's actually considered a realignment president.
Yeah. Yeah. The great realignment.
And,
yeah.
Yeah. And that's because he's seen as a sort of manager of this new industrial capitalist political economy.
It's funny because Wade McKinley, nobody ever heard of him, blah, blah, blah. But this is the dude, I always joke about this. Dude, this is the guy who was like the handmaid of industrial capitalism and empire. Get to it in a minute too.
Yeah.
So that the populists pose a real, and they're posing a challenge. Populists are rejecting now, right? We always think that capitalism is just this natural evolution, like natural law. The economists started using math to create this fiction that economics is like scientific and follows these particular rules, which is obviously ridiculous, right? Industrial capitalism was created by humans to benefit certain groups against others, class, based on class privilege, right? So the populists were a real threat. So in addition to the banks, the populists also said that their rivals, that the problem they had was with railroads, which again makes sense. Railroads, banks, all the instruments of a capital, the capitalist state, exists to serve industry more than agriculture, right? So banks are far more likely to give out loans. When there's a big debate, this is another kind of brief aside, but there's a big debate among historians now about the origins of capitalism. And you have this group called the New Historians of Slavery, or New Historians of Capitalism, which are arguing now that kind of capitalism was developed in the South before the Civil War. I totally reject that. I don't agree with that at all. I'm not a Marxist scholar like certain people in Brooklyn are, but I think on that one, I feel pretty confident in that banks and these other instruments exist to promote Northern industry and not really care about farmers and agriculture that much, which is why the pockets emerged. So they want to go after the railroads, doing the same thing. Railroads and banks get better rates to Northern industry. What people say, capitalism was in the South. If you're a bank in 1875, pick a number, pick any year in that era, right? If you're a banker in 1875 and two people show up and they want big loans, and one guy wants, it's Vanderbilt, wants a loan for railroad expansion, and the other one is somebody who wants to buy more acres to plant cotton, 10 times out of 10, the industrialist is going to get the loan, right? At better terms, better rates. And the same thing is happening in the insurance industry. Farmers, that's why farmers create their own like State Farm and Mutual of Omaha and companies like that. But then they also advocate dealing with the railroads, and they advocate nationalization, right? That's not capitalism. That's like when the state, so they want the state to take control, to appropriate the railroads and turn them into public utilities. They could set the rates, they could set the fees, the haul rates. And then that way, farmers would get an even a better deal. They would get an even a shakeout, allegedly.
And the railroad industry, as well as with the bankers and with the owners of the northern factories, they're the quintessential robber barons. And so this would be the equivalent of today saying that we should nationalize Google or Facebook or something like that. Like these are the people who are at the top of the economic pyramid.
I remember, I'm old, when the internet kind of became a thing, there were people, lefties, you know, who were saying, we need to create this public, make it a public utility, make a public trust, because it was pretty clear how that was going to, no one could foresee like the mega trillions of Zuckerberg and Musk and all this shit. You could see it was headed bad ways. And
yes, the cloud list, as Yana said.
I still don't disagree. I still disagree with that. But that's pretty clear, right? In the 1890s, that the government, they are robber barons. This is today when I talk about the lumpen oligarchs. These are the guys who were cutting edge in the 1870s and 1880s, right? Nowadays, though, this represents old industry, right? The manufacturing sector, and steel and coal and iron and automobiles and things. Those are obviously around 1875, but, you know, the railroads and things like that. So these old kind of extractive, heavy industry. And those are like cutting edge. So they demand and actually need priority in order to develop it in the global capitalist system. And the populace are being hurt, farmers and poor people, no matter what the economic policy is. It's very simple. You don't need an economics class to figure this out. Economic policies always damage poor people and working people and farmers and rural people more than anybody else. That's just that simple, right? And so farmers were really, in many ways, at the bottom of that barrel, right? So they advocate government create a bank and nationalize the railroads. It's just like incredibly anti-capitalist, right? And the populist also brought back, reinforced this old idea of currency revaluation. And so one of the big ideas behind the populists was called the free coinage of silver. So they too wanted the government to even expand upon the purchases of silver to go to a bimetallic system. Farmers believed that if silver were accepted as a currency, that more money would be available for credit, right? And so you would have government banks for farmers, specifically for farmers, that would be controlled, regulated by the government in order to benefit farmers. And then you would mint silver in order to create more money in those new banks that you created. And that money would then be available to farm communities in order for them to get back on their feet, to purchase land, to buy land, rent land, or whatever. Because in the period after the Civil War, the farm communities of America wiped out. I mean, if you remember, you're older, I'm younger. You remember the 1980s farm crises, like in Iowa and Minnesota? Yeah. So it's way worse than that.
Right.
This is worse than like the Dust Bowl, actually. It's probably the worst agricultural crisis in American history, right? Like I said, in some states, you had 50, 60% of the state leaving, right? There was a famous socialist, an agrarian socialist named Mary, what was her name? Kate Richards O'Hare, was that it? You know, I'm talking, shit, what's her name? This is embarrassing. I should know who this is. But she became really well-known nationally by writing these really radical, she was socialist, writing about agriculture there was a famous farm agitator. She called herself that, a woman named Mary Lease, L-E-A-S-E. And she was at a meeting one day, and you have these, it always reminds me of a scene from Blazing Saddles with old men saying, harumph, harumph, harumph. And finally, Mary Lee stood up and said, it's time to raise less corn and more hell. So you do have these kind of, this world, agrarian radicalism is a big thing that we lose track of in America. And the pocket is really obviously our manifestation of that. And they want, so they want the big, they have a lot going on. But I'd say the big part of their agenda is creating a public bank, the, nationalizing the railroads, and free coinage of silver. And these are very popular among working people. And that's the segue into the election of 1896. All right. I think you want to do a station ID here so that we can morph it and finish this off. So
can I say one thing, which I think, because I always like to introduce a little bit of pop culture, a really important piece of pop culture that actually comes out during this period is a little book by a guy named L. Frank Baum, which becomes a series of books. It's called The Wizard of Oz. And it frames this in a sense. And you have different characters in that book represent different elements of this story that Bob is talking about. We have the Tin Man, who represents the free coinage of silver. We have the Scarecrow, which represents the populist movement. And it's actually an important piece of pop culture, which was like telling a story about the time. Dorothy represents agrarian people, agriculture people, farm people who were swept up in the sort of tornado of the time, of the socioeconomic period of the time.
And the wizard is Trump, is that it?
Yeah, or I always felt like he was William Jennings Bryan, but I could be wrong.
I think one of the theories is
maybe it's just the actor in the movie just reminded me of him. Maybe that's what it was.
One of the theories I read was that the Cowardly Lion was Bryan. We'll get to Bryan in a bit. We haven't even mentioned it yet. But at any rate, so that's the populist agenda. At any rate, so the populists are kind of geeking up for 1896. They have momentum. They did very well in the midterms in 1894, locally, things like that. So they're kind of excited about 1896, right? They anointed this youngish guy, who's only 36, who was a congressman from Omaha and a brilliant speaker named William Jennings Bryan. And Bryan was a prairie populist. They used to use that term a lot, right? But in the best sort of way, Bryan used to make speeches and he would say, on one side, you have arrayed the plutocrats and the oligarchs and the people who run the machinery of finance. And on the other side, you have the people. Clearly a class-based ideology, right? And that's their calling card, right? And Bryan was very easily picked to be the nominee of the populist for the 1896 election. The story doesn't end there, though, because the Democrats had not yet met and had their convention. And so the Democratic Party was having a hard time choosing a nominee. They went to, it was over 100 ballots, wasn't it? In 1896, the Democrats, didn't they? Like, they had like an insane number of ballots. I think it was over 100. And they could not pick a candidate. And Bryan, who was a populist, came to, I don't remember the circumstances how he got there, but he showed up at the Democratic convention and gave a very famous speech.
Right? Cross of gold.
Cross of gold speech. It was a speech to advocate the free coinage of silver. And I forgot to write it down. I used to know it because I would do it in class just to show off, but I don't remember it anymore. But he said, what was it? He said, if you get rid of all the factories and you get rid of all the ships and everything, we'll survive. But if you get rid of all the farms, then the cities are just going to grow over in weeds and people won't eat. And at the end, the money line at the end, he says, we will not crucify mankind on a cross of gold. And he puts his hands out like he's being crucified on the cross like Jesus. And the crowd goes crazy and they name him the Democratic nominee. So he becomes the Democratic nominee. And that creates what's called fusion. So the populists and the Democrats join forces in 1896. One of the first things they do, though, is the Democrats, which is a Southern party, an agricultural Southern party, tell the populists that they have to ditch the black farmers. And they didn't. Many of these populists, like Tom Watson, who had been advocates of integration, they're in the same ditch as we are, became pretty vicious racist. And so they could take their foot off the neck of these black workers in the South. So the Democrats became, like, lost this chance to actually become a racially integrated party. And they dump, basically force out the black farmers, right? So Bryan is the nominee. He runs on this very progressive anti-capitalist platform in a lot of ways, right? And the Republican nominee is William McKinley. Getting back to this, William McKinley of Niles, Ohio. The election I think one way to look at elections in America and what politics really represents is to look at like the money, right? Look at the money, right? Who gives money? So Elon Musk obviously gave Trump $250 million or something like that, right? He has connections, right? Tech bros give money, right? Wall Street gives money, right? In 1896, the ruling class legit thought that the populace were a problem, like really a problem. I don't know if they thought that they could take over the country, but they were worried. And you know how I know that? Because that year in that election, William Jennings Bryan raised $300,000, right? Mark Hanna got to work and he called in all his people and they started Strong Army, Rockefeller and Carnegie and businesses and steel and banks and everything else. And you know how much money William McKinley raised in that election? Between $10 and $15 million.
$1896.
We're talking. So imagine today if one candidate raised $1 billion, that would mean the other candidate would have 40 to 50 billion, right? It's the biggest. In fact, McKinley's campaign haul that year amounted to 5% of the GDP, which is insane, right? Nothing's ever been close, right? The ruling class was so terrified of what the populace represented and whether they were legitimately positioned to do anything. I don't know. But the fact is, the ruling class was so worried about what they represented that they went all in to destroy them. And they did, right? Obviously, McKinley won that election. The populace did pretty well in that region, though, in the South, among farm communities and everything, right?
And the Midwest, ended, the Midwest right? states, too.
The Midwest states. But they ended after that, right? But that's really critical. McKinley represented the firewall. Remember when Obama went to Wall Street and he said, I'm the only thing standing between you and the pitchforks, right? That's kind of McKinley in real life, right? McKinley essentially speaking to these industrialists and these bankers and saying, hey, I'll protect you, but you got to help me out. And raises this immense amount of money. It was just staggering.
Yeah. Was there an element of the more unionized urban labor who were they in support of this Democratic populist fusion ticket, or were they more supportive of the Republicans because McKinley comes from this more pro-labor, I'm trying to protect you?
I think Northern labor still remained more Republican, I believe. I'd have to look at the data. McKinley won all the Northern states. I think if you look at the map, it was clear. Wasn't it? Like clearly,
I'm looking at it right now. I mean, all those industrial states, New England.
Yeah.
Bryan carries the South and states like Kansas and Nebraska and Iowa.
It almost looks like a Civil War
interior
map,
West.
Right?
Yeah.
It almost looks like Union versus Confederacy stuff, right? But it was a class-based move. And McKinley was the dude. He was the savior, the guy who was going to protect capitalism against these anarchist hordes and all that kind of stuff. And he did, right? He won the election.
Agrarian radicals.
Yeah, yeah. And that's important. And what that does is segue. If that had been the end of it for McKinley's career, who knows how it would have turned out, because the economy's still not doing well in 1897 and 1898, right? As president, he's overseeing an economy that's in deep trouble because of all these factors, overproduction, surplus capital, all kinds of stuff like that, right? But the two things that he's best remembered for, right? One is the tariff and his economic policy. And the second is, you know, kind of the final act of McKinley's political career, which can do quickly because it's fairly well known, which would be he's also the midwife of American imperialism, right?
But folks, you're listening to the Green and Red podcast. We're talking about Donald Trump's favorite president, which is William McKinley. If you like what you're hearing, please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit the subscribe button. If you're listening to this on one of the many audio platforms, give us a rate and review. And if you really like us, go to greenredpodcast.org and hit that support button or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast.
You can get stuff on the web. There's a million podcasts out there, literally, right? But you're not going to get like a really good analysis of William McKinley in very many places, right? And how many podcasters are there who have history degrees and they're from Niles, Ohio? Right?
It's the sweet spot.
It's like
of podcasting going on, right? Plus, we're bringing a particularly radical analysis to this too.
There are pictures of, not surprisingly, William McKinley. There are statues of all kinds of stuff. And when there's a couple bars there that have pictures of William McKinley, and I would always take a picture selfie next to it, say Niles' famous sons or something like that. But so McKinley became president. He's inaugurated in 1897. The economy is not in good shape at all. But he's bailed out by events overseas, right? The populace became so powerful because they exploited, and I mean that in a good way. They used the economic conditions that were prevalent at the time to make a case. And that's really important. The populists were a class-based organization, and that was the basis of their political ideology, right? Working people, farmers, and they did not back away from it. They're publicly calling for public ownership of banks and railroads and remonetizing silver, things like that. It's an anti-capitalist move, right? And it's defeated. Now, was it ever in a position to take over? I don't know if the capitalists would have let that happen. But clearly, it was popular. It represented significant levels of American society. And even though McKinley won, those problems that the populists, as well as the Knights of Labor and the American Railway Union and everybody else, Debs and everybody else pointed out, right? And there were attempts to create an alliance between Northern labor and the populists. Now that you mentioned, you asked that earlier, there were actually, and I'd have to go back and like reframe it. I don't remember it that well, but I do remember, I believe they were like reached out to people like Debs. I'm sure they did, right?
Right.
But at any rate, so even though they had defeated the populace, the economy still was in bad shape, both industrially and agriculturally. The conditions like capitalism had created through mechanization and corporatism and all kinds of stuff, productionism. This was like before the days of Taylorism, but obviously it's technology, right? So capitalism had created the means now to produce massive amounts of goods, mostly capital. It's mostly like things like steel and industries and factories and machines and stuff like that. But nonetheless, it created the ability to create massive amounts of goods, including in agriculture, right? So production at all levels was significantly increased. They're not selling it by the 1890s, right? So the stuff is just sitting there. You have massive levels of inventory, you have massive overproduction. Money isn't being reinvested because you already made too much stuff. So you have surplus capital, right? So there's clearly an economic crisis. You need to find new markets. A bunch of people had been theorizing about that for some time already. And the basic consensus on that, coming from like historian Frederick Jackson Turner, Alfred Thayer Mahan, Admiral Alfred Thayer Mahan, you had like Congregationalist ministers, you had theorists like Brooks Adams, who was John Quincy Adams' grandson, right? Their basic idea was that the United States had to find new markets. And essentially, you find new markets abroad. And that became the basis for that. And that really benefited McKinley. There had been a crisis going on just to the south of the United States in Cuba for quite some time. From the 1870s on, there had been a rebellion in Cuba led by Jose Marti and others against the Spanish. Cuba was Spain's last colony in the New World, the so-called New World. And the United States had been trying to obtain Cuba forever. From the early 19th century on, Southern slaveholders wanted the U.S. to acquire Cuba. Maybe that's why Trump is going after Greenland, right? And Canada and everything else, right? Maybe he wants to be more like William McKinley, right?
I'm on that working theory. That's a big working theory in my head. Panama, Greenland.
Yeah, right. So the United States had been demanding that Spain sell Cuba to Americans. And the Spanish always refused. And in the 1850s, in fact, the U.S. put forth a manifesto in Ostend, Belgium, which said that the United States had a God-given right. They had, by every right of God and man, they could simply take over Cuba if Spain refused to sell it. So by every right of God, that was it. Like a God-given right to take over Cuba. And the Civil War killed that. That was the main issue. Nobody was like opposed to taking Cuba, but Northern interests opposed it because they knew that it would be a slave state. If it became a state, it would be a slave state with two Southern senators, right? Two pro-slave senators, right? So after the Civil War, Americans are still interested in Cuba. There's a rebellion going on there. And the U.S., which obviously is the most anti-revolutionary force in history, right, supported the Cuban Revolution. Marti would come to New York and raise significant amounts of money. The American media gave him good publicity and so forth. And the U.S. sees an opportunity there. And so they're supporting Marti, and they're claiming it's because of self-determination and anti-colonialism and all that. It's because they want access and control over Cuba, right? So the U.S. is supporting Marti and the rebellion in Cuba against the Spanish. At the same time, and this is before McKinley's president, the United States stages, luckily, a bloodless coup to overthrow the government, the queen, in Hawaii. So the United States takes control of that too, right? So this is a period
annexes it, right?
And Hawaii is important. It's America's major producer of sugar, right? But it's also important because it's a way station, right? It's a coaling station. And if you're going to find foreign markets, you need two things. You need a big navy, and you need the ability to travel to Asia. Because Asia's, even then, everybody knows China has a lot of people, big consumer market, right?
Yeah.
Hawaii is really important in that regard. because it's halfway there, right? And it becomes a naval base, obviously, and it's a coal station. So Hawaii economically is very important. McKinley becomes president. Hawaii and Cuba are still on the front burner. And in 1897 or 98, as soon as he becomes president, McKinley ratchets up the pressure and he sends diplomats to the Spanish to again demand that Spain sell Cuba to the United States. And the Spanish basically say, this is our colony. It's none of your freaking business. Just shut up and get out of here, right? And this brings in the so-called gunboat diplomacy. McKinley sends warships to Havana as a show of force, right? The Americans are heavily invested in supporting Martí, the famous newspaper guy who would be like the Rupert Murdoch or whatever at the time. William Randolph Hearst sent reporters and photographers to Cuba. What was his line? You provide the pictures and you provide the pictures and I'll provide the war. Is that it? Something like that.
I thought it was vice versa. I thought it was you provide the war and I'll provide the pictures. But
no, I think it was like you provide the or you provide the story and I provide the war. Because the idea was give me something to work with and then I'll take care of it from there, right? And they were given they were blessed in a way because one of the ships in Havana Harbor, the American ship, one day there was a massive explosion, the Maine, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, what was the first thing the media said before investigating, right? It was Spanish terrorism. That's what we're thinking. This is terrorism. Look at, they're blowing up our ships. And so
remember the Maine.
Yeah, remember the Maine of the United States, right? So it's a cause to let, right? A boiler blew up, I believe. It was a mechanical thing. I believe it was a boiler, right? But it didn't matter. And so the American media jumped in gear, right? Think of like October 8, 2023, all the crazy shit that was said that day. Hamas did this, Hamas did that, blah, blah, blah. And now we know that it was actually the Hannibal directed and all that kind of stuff. Doesn't matter, right? When a war begins, you could just flood the information. This is before social media, so there's nothing to counteract that, right? So the American media just ginned it up like a massive war frenzy. Look at what the Spanish did, right? And so McKinley chose to send troops to Cuba, right? And that war lasted a few weeks. And it was Spain was in pretty decrepit shape by then. And so McKinley, as he called it, liberated Cuba. There's an interesting, my favorite story about that was, and this is from McKinley's diary. He said that like he was facing a crisis. What should he do, right, about Cuba? And so he, in his diary, says, I got on my knees and I prayed. And I don't know if it was Jesus or God or whoever. Somebody up there told him that he needed to invade Cuba to take it over in defense of free trade. So the United States opposed China in the open wars because China was violating the great Christian principle of open trade or free trade or something like that.
Right.
So McKinley, God gave him the okay. So he sent the troops to Cuba, conquered Cuba very easily. At that point, they annexed Hawaii officially, right? And then, you know, McKinley sent U.S. troops to Manila. And I always say to my class, why would you send troops to the Philippines? Because luckily, there's always one in there, at least, who says, Spanish colony. So essentially, the idea here, under the guise of humanitarian intervention, right? We're saving the Cubans from this Spanish tyranny. And the Spanish were brutal colonizers. They actually set up concentration camps. So, you know, they weren't lying, right? Oh, the motive obviously was contrived. The United States also had American investors had something like $100 million in 1898 money invested in Cuba, right? So that's a big factor in this too, right? And the United States goes to there. Then it sends troops to the Philippines under the guise, again, of humanitarian intervention. They overthrew the Spanish there as well. And that gave rise to what we call the beginning of the American Empire, right? So the United States very quickly acquired Cuba, Hawaii, the Philippines, and then also Guam and Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. And that became the precursor to the so-called open door notes and the open door ideology, which became the basis of American empire from that point on. The idea that we will demand open markets everywhere in the world. We will insist upon free trade. We reject European colonialism.
Two things I think are important to note is Spain was an easy target. Like they were a dying, decaying empire. They didn't really have the money or the ability or even the will to maintain
under siege at home too.
Yeah, under siege at home, but unable to maintain these faraway colonies. So it was an easy target for the U.S., which was starting at the beginning of the American Empire. The second important thing is that even though the U.S. ended the Spanish occupation of the Philippines, then it starts its own occupation of the Philippines, where they have to put down a pretty brutal rebellion by the Moro and people who are resisting U.S. occupation after the Spanish have left.
Yeah. In the 10 years after the U.S. allegedly liberated the Philippines, it had to suppress the Aguinaldo rebellion. American troops were there for a decade and killed about 200,000 Filipino soldiers and lost about 10,000 Marines. It was a really brutal and bloody battle. It was like people talk about Vietnam. It's like, right? So yeah, it was a big part of that, this really brutal suppression. And the U.S. took over Cuba as well. You had the Platt Amendment, Cuba, and Leonard Wood, who was a Civil War general, actually became the governor general of Cuba. And then the U.S. and the Philippines installed William Howard Taft as the governor general there. Oh, going back, I just say this just because it's fun. When the United States had that coup in Hawaii to overthrow Queen Liliuokalani, who took over the government, right?
It's the sugar company, right?
Yeah. Sanford Dole.
Dole. That's right.
As I always say, would you put the guy from Exxon in charge of, yeah, they did, Rex Tillerson.
I would say that we could do a whole show just on the U.S. occupation of the Philippines. Maybe we should do that someday in the future. The other thing I want to say is there's a great movie, which actually came out maybe 15 years ago. That's a John Sayles film called Gringo, which is a story about U.S. soldiers occupying the Philippines and fighting the insurgents and so on and so forth.
Yeah. There's a lot of, and you know who one of the name I haven't brought up yet, or maybe I did mention it, but who was really active politically at this time, too, was Mark Twain. And Twain was a real advocate and a champion. He was the president of the World Anti-Imperialist League and a champion of Filipino independence. And he wrote all the time about Emilio Aguinaldo in the Philippines. He compared him to George Washington and Joan of Arc and stuff like that.
It's really in the U.S. occupation of the Philippines, and that war, that occupation war, is a pretty important story to tell. I once took a class many years ago called The Forgotten Wars in U.S. History, and that was like one of them.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things that change within the U.S. military based on the Filipino occupation as well.
Actually, our good friend Clayton West written about that, about the bureaucratic changes that came after that era, right? It's just really vital. And my whole life, in a joking way, said, I'm from Nassau, and that's where the American Empire started and stuff like that. But once I started studying this more closely, it was more than just a joke. And then I'd wrap it up because we could talk about this for sure. We have talked about it for a long time. But when Trump said William McKinley was his favorite president, he said, okay, yeah, because of tariffs, because he took all this land and stuff like that. But then it's just like Trump doesn't know anything, typically, right? And McKinley was not a successful president. If I get it, the thing about Cuba and the Philippines is that was going to happen anyway, right? And it did end the crises of the 90s. You saw an economic recovery after that, just to finalize things with McKinley, right? You saw an economic recovery with that to the point where in 1900, he ran again and was reelected, right? But it didn't last long. He was in Buffalo, New York, I believe, right? Giving a speech. And wasn't it an anarchist? What was his name? Leon Czolgosz. Is that how you say it?
Yeah.
An anarchist shot and assassinated him.
After hearing a speech by Emma Goldman, no less.
Oh, there you go. Would he have been the 20th century Luigi or something like that? And then Teddy Roosevelt became president, ushering that era. Point is, McKinley is an important transformative figure, not just by chronologically, he actually spans two centuries, right? But he's there. He's been many ways in the story of America, right? He starts with the Industrial Revolution, industrialization in places like Ohio, which is crucial to industrialization in America. Until I grew up there, it was still one of the most important manufacturing centers in the world. People used to call, that area the Ruhr Valley of North America. It produced more steel than just about anybody, right? And so he's a product of that. He represents it. He and Mark Hanna are there at the creation of this kind of new industrial state, the political system that comes with it. They're advocates of tariff because of that. Tariffs support industry. They support big business. They'll damage Southerners. That's what gives rise to things like the populist movement, right? They're big advocates of tariff. They're pro-labor. They're actually somewhat progressive on issues of things like race, right? They're not like the Southern Democrats at all. And then McKinley becomes president, and he also ushers in this new empire, which has massive economic implications too. So he really is in many ways a transformative figure.
I also think, because we talked about this a lot, the sort of like class war that's happening during his political career from through the 1870s until 1901, which his life ends as an episode in that class war. He's assassinated by an anarchist. And I think that piece, that tension is, it's more than tension, but that conflict that's going on in American society is actually a really important thing to bring into this. That's a really important context to bring up. And like today, we're seeing a lot more class conflict than we have in the last couple of decades. We've really seen it ratchet up, at least since like 2008, the financial crash. And I think it's just an important sort of parallel. I don't like making saying like you should learn from your history or any of that bullshit, but like I do think there's some important parallels here.
You should learn from your history. The problem is, you know, as a historian, it's so fucking frustrating because like I spent my whole life thinking history is important and people should know it. And now history is really popular, but it's from these crazy people who like want to ban you from teaching everything, right?
And read Bill O'Reilly's latest book. There you go.
Yeah. You're not allowed to teach this or you're not allowed to teach. You're not allowed to say this. You're not allowed to talk about BDS. You don't want to talk about CRG or whatever, right? Just silly. But if you're so inclined, like politically, McKinley is a heroic figure. What's important, McKinley? McKinley is as important as anybody in suppressing resistance and challenges to the capitalist system. He's vital, right?
Right.
He defeats the populist. He creates these kind of imperial ambitions, which have significant meaning here at home, right? He's really important in creating this kind of modern Republican Party, which until the 70s, really, you know, we talk about the New Deal era along with the Democratic Party, but the kind of ideas created in this era, imperialism, the open door policies, which we haven't talked about a lot at all, really, but that's really important, right? Those kind of remain standard in the Republican Party, and really, again, up until the neoliberal era, right? So McKinley really is, I joke about it, but he really is a transformative figure in that regard. One who's misunderstood by Trump, right? The tariffs didn't work. McKinley was not doing well as president. He was able to acquire Cuba and the Philippines because Spain was just falling apart, whereas Trump is picking fights with NATO. And that's neither here nor there. It's really critical stuff, right? And to get my last obligatory shot at, when people like make glib remarks, Trump, of course Trump is a neoliberal because he's not a liberal. That's just silly. And Trump does break with a lot of kind of conventions that we've been seeing recently, right? He's economically, the guy's opposed to trade pacts, right? That's the hallmarks. Yeah, granted, he's for deregulation, but like basically a lot of, and to suggest that we, McKinley, is the president you need to emulate is, you really are reverting to, in many ways, that old school imperialism, old school, like European forms of government and things like that, right? It's not a modern state, right? And tariffs, and I think that in many ways, the proof of the pudding is in the taste, right? He's backed off on the tariffs and he hasn't done anything yet. Now he will at some point, but it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Because people who he might be forced to listen to a little bit are telling him the tariffs aren't a good idea. So be it. But I think talking about McKinley again is really instructive because it shows us what we're headed toward, right?
Yeah. I think, unfortunately, as they're deconstructing the federal government and lifting up these ideas, which are apparently from the late 19th century, I think at least we have an idea of what they're thinking about when we look at the political life of William McKinley.
Deregulation is obviously critical to neoliberalism. It's inherent in it, but that doesn't mean you get rid of everything. Neoliberalism demands these kind of controlling interests, right? These bureaucracies and things like that. They could control that, right? NAFTA courts, right? That's neoliberalism, right? Yeah. These kind of regulations on industry, right? Industry, that's the part, and we're going to see this. We've talked about this many times, right? Going back to the old Gabriel Coco arguments, right? A lot of these businesses are not going to be happy with the stuff Trump is doing because it's really mucking everything up, right? It will damage damage their global interest as well with retaliatory tariffs and all that kind of stuff. But you are going to see pushback against Trump, not from the Democratic Party because they're fucking useless. They're on a morphine drip, right? But a lot of businesses will be damaged by what like people like Musk and Trump are doing. It'd be interesting to see it fall out. Some of the stuff Trump is doing, the other day he said, we need to cut the military budget. Obviously, I think that's a great idea. Brilliant idea. But he's not going to do that. And he's not going to do it in any kind of meaningful way. He's going to send more business to SpaceX and Tesla or something like.
When they said that, the stocks of companies like Lockheed and General Dynamics and all of those companies actually plummeted after they said that.
Yeah, they're not going to let him get away with that. I know he doesn't. He thinks he's smart and he's not going to listen to anybody. There are class constraints, I believe. Not many anymore. I figured they would have gotten rid of the guy. Not like deep state. If there was a deep state, Trump would have been gone 8 years ago, 9 years ago, right? He would have fallen off a cliff or gone fishing with Al Neary or something like that, right? But yeah, so anyway, three cheers for William McKinley from Niles, Ohio. I'll get some pictures of the McKinley Memorial. When I was in high school, for a time, there was a place called the Old Main Ale and Chowder House, which was located allegedly in William McKinley's birthplace. Really good, like clam chowder. They would serve us beer when we were 18.
There you go.
Which actually was the legal age. It was the legal age in Ohio, but they would give us real beer, not 3.2 beer. So anyway, well, yeah, William McKinley High School, and it's all kinds of tributes. I don't have my hat with me. It must be in Ohio, but I was wearing my Niles McKinley hat for this. So anyway, that is our little claim to fame. We have William McKinley. We also have Staunton and Alice Lynn. Clarence Darrow is actually grew up like 30 minutes away in Kinsman, Ohio, right? Huh?
There you go. Yeah. Folks, we've been talking about President Trump's, I hate calling him President Trump. We've been talking about Donald Trump's favorite president, a second or third tier favorite son of Niles, Ohio, William McKinley. And if you like what you're hearing, check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit that subscribe button. If you're listening to this on one of the many audio platforms, give us a rate and a review. And then if you really like us, go to greenredpodcast.org and hit that support button or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. And we will be bringing more and more to you because we have a lot of the good stuff in the works. And until we talk again, misbehave, make a lot of trouble, and don't take any shit off anybody. We'll talk to you later. Bye.
Doc says, McKinley, I can't find that long buffalo to Washington. Rural Bell in the White House, he's doing his best. McKinley in the graveyard, he's taking his rest. He is gone, long old time. Hush up, little children, now don't you fret. You draw a pension at your papa's death from Buffalo to Washington. Roosevelt in the White House singing out the silver cup. He lives in the graveyard, he never wakes up. He is gone.